May it please the court. Rachel John's decision not to register to vote was not due to a lack of interest in or knowledge of the system of electoral politics, but rather because of her lack of faith in that system. As an African-American woman living in St. Louis, she consistently received a message from her elected officials that the government is not interested in your community's voice, and it does not trust your community to know its own best interests. Ironically, Your Honors, after Ms. Johns has had her faith restored in the system and is now seeking to participate in that system, she is getting the exact same message from the very person who currently serves her district in the State House of Representatives, and that is why she is running for this office. She intends to assure to her community back in St. Louis that the person who is there does in fact understand and appreciate their voice and intends to make it heard and effective at the state level. Your Honors, the issue has been raised on appeal by our opponents that Ms. John's decision not to register was not expressive conduct within the protection of the First Amendment. As we noted in our reply brief, that was in fact stipulated below, that her conduct was expressive conduct.
Isn't that a question of law?
I don't believe it is a question of law, Your Honor. They've actually asserted that facts are necessary to support that determination.
They can stipulate to the facts, and then the question is whether those facts are sufficient to, as a matter of law, to prove the point that it's expressive conduct.
Your Honor, I would agree that the ultimate question of whether whether a particular expressive act is within the ambit of the First Amendment is a question of law. To the extent that what our opponents have disputed is whether there are sufficient facts to support that point of law, our contention is that having stipulated that her actions were expressive in the trial court, they deprived us of the opportunity to put on any facts that might have been disputed that would have supported that point of law. So at this point, it would be manifestly unjust to question whether, as a matter of law, her conduct was expressive when we have been deprived of the opportunity.
Because it's been argued that there's no indication that she openly said anything about, I'm not registering because I don't believe in this system, or this is a statement by me, you know, by not registering, that objection to certain issues and so forth, that you want an opportunity to make that a record if this court thinks that that's relevant, whether or not there's such evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. If the court believes that that's relevant, then because this was sent up on cross motions for judgment on the pleadings, then we should have the opportunity to establish those facts. Given the circumstances and the time limitations that we're dealing with, and also with the direct assertion in Ms. John's affirmative defenses that her decision was expressive and the stipulation made by the respondent that it was expressive, we believe it unnecessary to actually send this case back to establish
those facts. What paragraph in your answer do you claim that you stated sufficient facts to preserve the equal protection claim? What paragraph in your answer?
Well, Your Honor, each paragraph where we reference the First and 14th Amendment rights that are at issue, as we noted in our reply brief, the standard for whether an issue has been preserved does not depend on citing a particular clause. It depends on citing a constitutional provision. We did repeatedly cite the First and 14th Amendments.
I understand you started the article, but what facts were set forth in conjunction with that article which preserved the claim you're making now?
The undisputed fact that had Ms. Johns registered to vote before a certain date, she would be authorized to run for office. The fact that she did not register before a certain date means that she is not under the challenge provisions eligible to run for office. The class that has been set up is persons who register before a certain date are eligible, persons who register after a certain date are not eligible, and the facts that establish that are that Ms. Johns registered after the specified date, so she is part of the class.
You're saying the very
excluded.
Facts you relied on for your other arguments also are the same facts you relied on below for
Indeed,
your argument under equal protection.
Indeed, Your Honor.
And I believe in your motion for judgment on the pleadings or reply, you specifically said you believe those facts and the registration limitation violated equal protection of the 14th Amendment, so you did cite a specific clause.
We did note the equal protection provision repeatedly in our cross motion for judgment on the pleadings.
And I just beg to differ. In your cross motion, you say there are two distinct bases for her constitutional challenge. First, that the voter registration requirement unconstitutionalized, penalized her by disqualifying her for running for office, engaging in protected speech. That was the First Amendment argument. Your second point did not address any equal protection argument. And every time in your cross motion, equal protection, those words are ever found, it's in reference to how that issue was analyzed in other cases, but you never tied it back to or made any specific reference that you were making a specific equal protection argument.
Well, Your Honor, under the applicable standard of review, the courts do not separate out the various rights that are at issue. They take them all as a whole. That's one of the primary teachings of Anderson versus Celebrezze, the primary case that sets the standard that this court must apply. It discusses interwoven strands of liberty and says we don't assess these separately, we assess them together. The reason we've talked about equal protection on appeal is if this court decides that all of the fundamental rights that are typically evaluated in a regular election issues case are not relevant here, then we would fall back to only the Equal Protection Clause. But the Equal Protection Clause is part of the 14th Amendment, which we repeatedly
cited. And
there's
lots of other things in the 14th Amendment, too, besides the Equal Protection Clause. The trial court never addressed it, never thought it was in front of it. And we're a court that reviews the decision of the trial court. How can we, you know, correct the trial court's decision if they never were given an opportunity to address it?
Your Honor, this court has inherent authority to address issues that are properly before it, and the fact that the trial court declined to specifically single out the Equal Protection Clause as a basis for ruling against my client does not mean that the issue wasn't addressed and ruled
upon.
But
you do have to raise constitutional issues at the first opportunity in the trial court. You can't raise them for the first time in this court.
That's correct, Your Honor, but
did,
the standard...
Did you raise the 14th Amendment and Equal Protection when you said in your... filings on the judgment on the pleadings that the Missouri Supreme Court has held that the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause requires the application of strict scrutiny to a provision that denies the right to run for public office based on a particular office sought, and that you think that here the two-year residency the two-year registration requirement for a state representative is such a violation?
Yes, Your Honor. That is a direct assertion of the Equal Protection Clause as part of my client's claim. If this court is not persuaded that equal protection is at issue, we still have to address the Anderson test. And the Anderson test calls into question whether there is a particular degree of burden placed on a citizen's First or 14th Amendment rights. We've cited roughly a half dozen U.S. Supreme Court majority decisions that state that where you are completely excluding a candidate from a given election, that is a heavy burden on that candidate's rights.
But here that's a temporary burden, one election cycle.
Your Honor, I would
that's
submit
that's not a that, permanent burden.
I would submit that in all of the other cases that we cited, it was a temporary burden as well. Not only was it temporary, it was potentially avoidable. And that was one of the major points that the Supreme Court made again and again in those cases, is that the burden was high, but it was still meetable, and they still found that there was a heavy burden. In this case, she is completely excluded from running in this election cycle, and that makes a difference. We pointed out in particular the Cuspers case, U.S. Supreme Court case, where a citizen was going to be excluded for a period of 23 months from participating in a primary election. That's very similar to the issue here. She would be excluded for 2 years from participating in an election. It's a temporary burden, but it is a very heavy burden, and that's what matters. In each of these cases that the Supreme Court was deciding, they were dealing with one specific election. That was the central point in each of those cases, and here we're dealing with the same thing.
Is this any different than any other registration requirement? By their nature, a registration requirement requires registration for a certain duration. So if this is temporary, any such restriction is temporary in that sense. And the question is whether it's a substantial burden for that period.
Generally speaking, I agree with you, Your Honor. I do think that there is a difference between, for example, a jurisdiction that allows same-day registration and a jurisdiction that says you must wait a certain period of time before you can exercise your right to vote. But yes, you're right. In a sense,
any registration requirement. I mean, by their nature, they're temporal restrictions.
I'm sorry,
by their nature, they're temporal restrictions if it's a registration requirement.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
But you're asking us to strike down not a statute, but a constitutional provision as written by the people and has been a part of our Constitution for over 140 years. No person has ever brought this challenge before. It seems to be, you always hear in elections, you hear people say, well, that person hasn't even been registered to vote, or that person hasn't been registered for very long. We even hear it today in our presidential campaign with certain candidates' children not being eligible to vote in certain primaries. It's still something that people seem to be concerned about. You know, because it's a constitutional provision as opposed to a statutory provision, shouldn't we look at this differently?
No, Your Honor. And my initial point on that is that if the people decide that this is a matter that's important to them, the people can decide that and choose not to vote for Ms. Johns. It's a legitimate matter of political conversation. It is not a legitimate matter to keep someone out of the conversation.
But shouldn't this provision be corrected by a constitutional amendment as opposed to the courts?
No, Your Honor. I'm asking this court to do exactly what the U.S. Supreme Court did in Quinn versus Millsap in 1989. They dealt with a provision of the Missouri Constitution that had long been part of the Missouri Constitution, and they took it up and they said, you know what, this violates the U.S. Constitution. It cannot be allowed to stand. The issue in that case is that the requirement that was being imposed on would-be office holders was not rationally related to the office that they intended to hold. That's why the U.S. Supreme Court struck it down. That's why this court should strike it down here.
Judge, as Judge Russell points out, it's in our Constitution since the beginning. Of course, Judge Russell wasn't able to vote until 1920 when the U.S. Constitution was amended to allow women to vote. Yet that was the Missouri Constitution that women couldn't vote. I don't think we ever changed that. But the U.S. Constitution, never voted on by the people, did say women could vote. They seemed to think it was better to change that kind of policy, even though it was in the Constitution of Missouri and in the tradition of Missouri, that women had no right to vote until 1920.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And if I may point out, there are any number of laws and or constitutional provisions that have been on the books for an extended period of time that the U.S. Supreme Court eventually decided were not consistent with the rights secured in the U.S. Bill of Rights. And due to the Supremacy Clause, it doesn't matter if it's a state constitutional provision or if it's a state statute. If the U.S. Constitution prohibits a distinction from being made or an exclusion from being imposed, it doesn't matter whether it's a state constitutional provision or a state statute. Those state provisions must give way in light of the federal rights protected under the U.S. Bill of Rights. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Good morning. Ms. Johns' act was not expressive conduct protected by the First Amendment.
Is that a position contrary to the position you took in the trial court?
No, it's not. The position that we took in the trial court was admitting that Ms. Johns intended to express something. But there's a two-part test when you're dealing with whether something is protected conduct. And the test is, in deciding whether conduct is protected under the First Amendment, the Supreme Court asks whether there's an intent to convey a particular message and whether the likelihood was great that the message would be understood by those who viewed it. The likelihood of it being great, first off, was never a fact that was alleged that anybody saw it, that anybody heard it, or that anybody understood it. What was stipulated to was a factual allegation in the answer that Ms. Johns was expressing an act. She may have been expressing an act, but that's not the question. The question is, again, what's the likelihood that the message would be understood? And as we pointed out in our brief, for somebody to understand this message, somebody would have to go onto the voter register rolls, somebody would have to look for her name, somebody would have to not find her name, and somebody would have to understand what that means that her name isn't there.
How would Ms. Johns know that you were challenging the impact of what you did not, you stipulated to? Because it's, you stipulated to the fact that she declined to register as an expressive act of protest.
Yes, and that goes to the first part of the test, which is the intent aspect.
But did she know below that you were contesting that it was communicated? Was that an issue? Was that an issue below?
It was. We brought up the fact that certainly in the Buckley context, that it only says Buckley is a Supreme Court case that says that not registering to vote implicates First Amendment, at least in the ballot context.
Did you say? But she didn't express that protest to other people or communicate it.
No, I didn't. But it's also her burden to show that it's expressive conduct that's protected, and
but
it's something that
certainly your stipulation could be read that you were not challenging that issue. Don't you agree?
I think that it can be read that I wasn't challenging, or that my client wasn't challenging the intent. Her intent here may have been expressive, but that doesn't change the fact that
On the judgment of the motion of pleadings, the facts are viewed in the most light favorable.
Well, they were cross motions.
I understand, but even then, we're back to this issue. Nobody can stipulate to a legal conclusion.
That's correct. And in this instance, I think the legal aspect of this is the likelihood, whether the likelihood was great, that that her message would have been understood. And I will also point out that in the trial court below, we filed, the plaintiff in below filed a motion for judgment on the pleadings. There was a cross motion for judgment on the pleadings, and there was no opportunity to respond before there was an oral argument and a ruling. Now, we waived any argument because these issues were addressed by the court and addressed below, but this is something that Judge Bush expressly brought up when he said that this is no more expressive than, and he gave a host of examples of what is expressive conduct. But again, there's a legal issue here. What's the likelihood that it's going to be understood? But even if this was expressive conduct, the burden here is temporary and minimal. A case that the opponent does not reference in any of his briefs is Stiles v. Blunt, which is an Eighth Circuit case dealing with this constitutional provision, where the court held that a 23-year-old could not run for office and referred to the burden on the 23-year-old as de minimis. The 23-year-old.
There's a difference between an age limitation and a durational requirement of registration, isn't there?
Absolutely. But you first have to look, in this Anderson versus Celebrezze test, you first have to look at the burden. And then you have to look at the rationale for the burden.
Right.
And the burden is the same on the 23-year-old as it is on Ms. Johns. The burden is you cannot run this time, but you can run next time.
And can you compare the relevance of the apparent belief that you have to have a certain level of maturity and life experience to run for office versus what maturity and life experience do you gain by registering?
Well, I think it's a different rationale or different reason for justifying this law. And maturity may not apply in this situation, and I reference Stiles v. Blunt simply for the fact that the burden is de minimis because you can run in 2 years. But I think there's some interesting aspects of registration that are not protected by or not served by an age requirement or a residency requirement, and this is particularly true because in Missouri, residency is domicile. Residency is somebody who lived here and then could have left but intended to return. So you could have somebody who's gone for 10 years, but they intended to return, and if there's no registration requirement, they've taken no steps to participate in the Missouri political process.
But the registration requirement is, at best, a state requirement. It doesn't actually even say in this state. But assuming it's registration in this state, for the purposes of my question, it's only required for state representative and senator. It's not required for attorney general, not required for governor, lieutenant governor, auditor, any number of offices. Why is it relevant? Why is it rational to require it for that and not for other offices?
Well, I think that you have to look at the history of our candidates in or our representatives in this state, which is you have a history of people running for an initial office and then working their way up. And so once a state representative decides...
Because you might run for state rep before you run for governor, therefore it's okay to have a registration requirement for state rep, but not for governor?
Well, I think that...
I mean, if we're looking at, is this, either is this a rational basis for that, or if in fact we believe it's a substantial burden, is there a compelling state interest in doing this, and could it be more narrowly tailored?
Well, let me take these a couple different ways. One is, as I mentioned, there's, I think, an expectation by the people that this candidates would start at a bottom level and raise, go higher. But there's also a significant level of scrutiny on statewide that does not exist for state rep and state senator. I mean, you have a state rep who many people may not know, and this is an assurance that this person is who they say they are, and has at least taken the step to participate in a residency requirement.
And you don't have to vote, though, if you're registered. That's not a requirement. Or that you've been active in public affairs, or that you've run for local office, or that you've done anything other than send in the form. So how is that rationally related to these purposes you're discussing?
Well, because, Your Honor, it's first off, it protects against frivolous candidacies because it shows who the person is. You have to, when you're registering
to
vote...
What do you mean by that?
Well, when you register to vote, you have to identify that you are who you say you are, that residency and age don't really deal with.
And do you have to do that when you register for office, too, to run for office?
Well, you have to sign a form saying that you are running for office, yes.
In King v. Welch, there was a certain individual who went off to a high school in New Jersey, went off to college in New Jersey, went off to law school in Virginia, declared himself to be a citizen of Virginia when he took the bar in Virginia, and he went to work at a law firm called Covington and Burling. But the testimony was from, I think, Mr. Covington or Mr. Burling, that his heart always belonged in Missouri. And this court, in a 5-2 vote, said he could run as governor of the state of Missouri in 1972. And that was Kit Bond.
Yes, and that's because of a residency requirement, but what was not at issue is a registration requirement. And that is all the time I have. I've reserved a certain amount of time for the state.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. That's right, Judge Seidelman. When in the appellant's brief, they talk about what we gain by having a candidate who actually has residence. In Missouri, we don't gain that from residents. Kit Bond proved that. But we may gain it, we aren't assured it, we may gain it with registration. After all, registration means you can only be registered in one place. When you come in and register, you say, I'm here, I'm not somewhere else.
But you don't have to register in the district. You could have been registered
right
up till right before the election someplace else in the state.
Yes, because we don't require registration be moved until near the time of the election. But understand that we are electing not just representatives of districts, but we are electing a General Assembly that is presumed to act on behalf of the people of the state as a whole.
The registration requirement, though, could serve that purpose without having any duration. The 2 years is a significant issue, as opposed to just as a requirement that you be a registered voter.
No, I disagree with that. I think the people of this state, long before the 1945 Constitution and then continued in the 45 Constitution, have determined that it is rational, at least, that we have people in the legislature whose commitment to participating in the life of the people of the state of Missouri is sufficiently serious that they will register in Missouri and thus nowhere else for 2 years.
And why is it the right of the state to make the decision that this, as opposed to other indicators of involvement in public life, which may be much more substantial than sending in a form, is the only way you can show sufficient involvement? And second, if we actually had a provision, do you think it would be constitutional if it said you must show you care about and you're very involved in civic life in order to run for political office? Because that's in effect what you're saying this is a shorthand for.
I think what we have made the determination of is that there is a minimum level that we require. And it is a level that is easily verifiable, is today universally applicable in the United States. It is minimal. It doesn't tell us very much, but it does tell us something. Under oath, it tells us something. There's nothing else that we could look at in the current system that would substitute for that. And I don't know whether we could do something that would be more effective in determining that people actually were here participating. We've just made the decision that there's one thing we're going to require, and that is that you make yourself eligible to participate.
Have courts upheld a durational requirement?
There are only a few cases in which durational registration requirements have even been addressed,
right.
And only one in which it is comparable to this one. That was in the 1960s in another state, long before the cases that today dictate how we address the U.S. constitutional provisions, and a rather curious set of facts.
But there are no cases that have upheld a...
Well, because the challenges other than that case have come where it's like a 10-year registration requirement. And I won't disagree that a 10-year registration requirement is a severe burden on someone's ability to run. But when you look at cases like Stiles that say it merely postponing running isn't the same as a 10-year bar, which is, in effect, a prohibition for many people.
How do we measure the standard rational then? Or do we come up with some different standard between rational and strict scrutiny?
The courts have dealt with these cases, at least ever since cases like Burdick and Buckley and Anderson, as a kind of a balancing test. And so on the one side, you look at the extent of the burden, and here there is some burden. It's a burden that she assumed as a choice. That is, we didn't impose this burden on her. She chose to do this. And it's a brief burden. It's a two-year burden.
It's not a two-year burden. Here it's a three-year and nine-month burden.
No.
And even if she had registered the week after the election, she would not have been able to vote 2 years later. So she has to wait 4 years in effect to run.
It's not vote. She'd not be able to run. And
to
voting,
run for office.
I mean, voting is always dealt with in a much stronger term than candidacy. But no, I mean, if there's a special election in a district in which she lives December or January, February, she can run.
But here, where she wants to run for this office, she cannot run for it, and she won't be able to for
until
another
there is
2 years.
Election.
So here, it's 3 years and 9 months, and it could be 3 years, 11 months, and 3 weeks.
By her choice.
Because you have to do it by two.
By her choice.
Why is that not arbitrary?
Well, to a certain degree, any limit is arbitrary. And I believe we quote one of the cases in our brief where the U.S. Supreme Court says you can't just say it's arbitrary. If it's 2 years, if it's 1 year, if it's 18 months, whatever line we draw is arbitrary to some degree. And so if you're going to insist that we have a line that's not arbitrary, we have no line, and then what Mr. Rowland is asking you to do is eliminate the registration requirement entirely.
It's like Potter Stewart, we know it when we see it.
Maybe.
Mr. Layton, in your brief, you say that the duration registration obviously applies to state rep, state senator,
yes.
Not to the executive branch, and that's because of the state rep and state senator having the ability to tax. Can you expound upon that?
Frankly, I don't know why that was originally done. I suspect it's like Mr. Vianello said, that there just wasn't a perceived need for this. And understand that under rational basis review, we are not required when we see a problem to address all aspects of that problem at once. And so it certainly is understandable that the people
140 years wasn't time to address the other.
That assumes that the problem extends to those. I mean, understand that this goes back to where every county in the state of Missouri, including a county that only had a few hundred people, had a representative in the state's General Assembly. And so they dealt with the House of Representatives really very differently than they dealt with these statewide officers.
If we do find this to be a substantial burden, can you argue why you think it's nonetheless constitutional?
Well, if you say it's a substantial burden and you say it's subject to strict scrutiny, then I don't know that I have an argument. But understand that the United States Supreme Court has said that these candidacy items are not fundamental
well,
rights.
Well, they are to the extent they impose a substantial burden on the voter, and that is what
on the case. Voter.
Yes, and they say they're in their cases that those are inextricably linked, but not necessarily in every case. So we look at the facts. Of
yes,
the
but they also have said that when it's a single candidate, that is not a severe imposition on the voter. And this is one candidate. This isn't.
And in what case are you relying on there?
I'd have to look.
Was that a durational registration requirement?
No, okay. No, because the U.S. Supreme Court has never dealt with a durational registration requirement. What they typically deal with is you have someone coming in and saying, I'm a third party, or I want to affiliate with a third party, I want to affiliate with an independent candidate, I can't do something in the major parties, what do I do? And in those cases, the court has said, when you tell someone that you can't have on the ballot the kind of people that you support, not one person, the kind of people you support, that's a severe burden. But the Supreme Court has never said that eliminating one candidate, saying that this particular person can't be on the ballot, is itself enough to result in strict
scrutiny. Because this is an as-applied challenge, correct?
I believe so.
It's not a facial?
I believe so.
Can you elaborate on the state's justifications on the voter registration requirement versus the residency requirement? Are those justifications different, the same?
Well, I think they are related. That is, I think both of them contribute to an attempt to have people in the General Assembly who have made a commitment to and have some minimal level of involvement in the state prior to taking office.
You know, but the Constitution said qualified voter in Missouri.
Yes.
And then the in Missouri was omitted. Mm-hmm. If we give effect to that such that you could be a qualified voter anywhere, what does that do to your justification argument?
Well, at that point, then I'm not sure that the qualified voter has any meaning left. And so I'm not sure how to justify it.
But to be a voter, you have to be a resident of Missouri.
Whatever that means, yes, you do.
You know, you also made an interesting argument that I hadn't heard before, that she did this with knowledge. In other words, when she said, I'm not voting for whatever reason, she also knew that by not voting, she would not be able to run for an office that had a requirement such as this.
Yes.
So her action before, how could she have challenged this back then? A deck action or something like that?
A deck action. I said that because in Cusper, the U.S. Supreme Court said that the restriction there was merely the result of the elector's voluntary failure to take timely measures to enroll, which means to register, although they're by party. And that's what we have here.
And what was the case?
That's Cusper, K-U-S-P-E-R, it's cited in the
Yeah, but what you're arguing is that she knows when she's decided not to vote, that she's also going to run for an office two years later.
She knows she can't run for office 2 years later. She's presumed to know the law. So when she made this conscious decision, which her attorney says it was a conscious decision to do this. When she made that, she is required to know the law and understand that there are certain consequences from that. And one of those is she can't run for office. It is a purely voluntary act that she took that separated herself from others. This isn't where we have two groups of people, the people who believe in this political philosophy and this, and we disadvantage one over the other. This is one where she chose to say, I'm going to disqualify myself from running for office. And I understand from Mr. Rowland that it was a conscious choice on her part.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I believe what we just heard is the Solicitor General arguing that the state of Missouri must be allowed to penalize a citizen for engaging in expressive activity protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. That cannot be correct. Your Honors, to address several of the points that were raised in the response.
Could you address one point he made, which is that there are no other cases where the U.S. Supreme Court has found that eliminating a single candidate is a severe burden?
Your Honor, I would need to look at the cases to isolate them. I don't believe that that assertion is correct, but I cannot cite a specific case right now.
You agree they've never struck down a durational requirement?
The issue has never been in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. Every state Supreme Court and federal court of appeal to deal with an issue like this one, a restriction like this one, has found it to be unconstitutional. Some of those courts applied heightened scrutiny for different reasons. Some of those courts simply said there's no rational basis.
And were those in the case of a candidate challenging them, so it would have been an individual case, or were those a broad declaratory judgment action? Do you know the context
I believe in each of those, it was situations where candidates for office were challenging the requirements. So, for example, in the Henderson case out of the Fifth Circuit, you had candidates for school board who were told you have to have been a registered voter for 3 years. They challenged, and the Fifth Circuit says that's not acceptable under the U.S. Constitution.
How do you define heightened scrutiny? I mean, you can define strict scrutiny by saying everything else has to be tried before you declare that law constitutional. How do you define heightened scrutiny in this sense?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, the U.S. Supreme Court has been kind of squishy on this issue. They have not established.
That's what I'm asking for.
Well, I mean, what they've said is it's a sliding scale. You evaluate the degree of the burden, and then you balance it against the interests that the government has asserted and the means that they have chosen to advance those interests. It is an incredibly squishy assessment. What the courts have typically done is they've said, if we believe this burden is heavy, then they lean more in the direction of a strict scrutiny analysis. If they believe that the burden is negligible, then they lean more in the direction of a rational basis analysis. As we've pointed out in our briefing, using many cases, this particular restriction cannot stand under either analysis. If you're applying a more heightened level of analysis that looks more like strict scrutiny, Mr. Layton has acknowledged they can't meet that burden. We've also pointed out cases that say that under a rational basis level of scrutiny, it still can't meet the burden because whether someone's name is on this list tells you nothing about the person's qualifications to serve their fellow citizens in office. If there are no further questions, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.